I'm getting epiphanies, just to let you
know. I know, that's what it's all about, is
well, it's just fucking amazing, you know, because all I did was live. All Mom did was live and followed our nose. I mean, all I did was want to survive, want to take care of my lady and our child or children. And I was always, I get, obviously, I've always been very good at making money.
Okay, so it's the 1980s in Mill Valley, California, and my dad's pot smuggling career is going very well. After quitting in the mid-70s and then getting back into the game with a Lebanese hash trip in the late 70s, my dad is now doing smuggling trips every few weeks or so. Nothing was regular, but the best my dad can guess, on average, he's moving 500 to 1,000 pounds of pot locally and 1,000 to 2,000 pounds cross-country now and again. Now, remember, there's no normal or average in pot smuggling. And my dad doesn't want his pals who are listening to think, bah, this guy's full of shit.
It's important to be at least not too much bullshit because, I mean, I'll get shit from my pals about, what is this crap?
If I don't get the average right?
Well, if I don't get, you know, numbers. But the numbers were always, who the fuck knew? You know, I mean, you didn't add it up all the time.
Now, he isn't sure of the exact numbers he's smuggling, but by the 80s, Dad's career is thriving. There is a lot of pot and a lot of cash.
So there's a shitload of cash around all the time.
There is cash around,
hunks
yes.
Hunks of cash, right.
Hunks of cash, and but ergo the safe.
Okay, we'll get to the safe in a moment. So my parents recently got ATM cards. Now by recent, I mean in the last 10 years or so. Even though the automated teller machine, aka ATM, was invented in the 60s, they just got these cards. The ATM was first used in Europe in the late 60s before making its way to Australia and then the US in the 70s and becoming ubiquitous in the 90s. Now, of course, my parents weren't into ATM cards because being pot smugglers, they lived a primarily cash life. So it was common for them to unfurl a thick spiral of cash for the many grown-up errands they had to accomplish. Now, you can't store all this money at the bank. The smuggler's bank is deep in the earth, called savings and loam, a term coined by my smuggler dad's colleague. In today's episode, we're talking all about cash, from bricks of hundreds to rolls of quarters, and how my parents and other smugglers used it, where they put it, and how they made it seem like the money they made was from an honest living. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter.
Rolling a doobie, young, rich, and groovy, making it up as we roll along. Rolling along, far out country road, following the sunshine as we go, chasing after dogs and kids and kilos, making it up.
One issue particular to pot smugglers is volume. First, of course, in terms of the product. We heard about the various ways my dad had to transport and hide pot. Volume is also an issue when it comes to dealing with cash. You have to come up with clever ways to transport big sums of money and a place to stash it. My parents had difficulty figuring out where to store all their cash at our Mill Valley home. Remember in the first episode when we talked about my dad misplacing $500,000 in the yard from the Lebanese hash deal? Well, he had buried the safe under a blackberry bush, but then the yard was re-landscaped and he lost his landmarks. This is actually a fairly common practice for smugglers.
Everybody does that. They
buried their
they
money.
Buried their money in the backyard.
We used to bury our money because there was...
Just like the Vikings.
Savings and loam.
Savings and loam, right.
My dad's colleague from his biggest trip ever, we'll get to that story, a singular artist and smuggler we'll call Baseball, titled the practice of burying cash in the backyard, Savings and Loam. I love that. It's hilarious. There's a quintessential Mill Valley story that went around the smuggler's grapevine. This story is bursting with the first world opulence and absurdity of smuggler problems in Mill Valley.
This was a story that I heard from another person in Mill Valley, and it was this guy had a bunch of money.
Well, he was a smuggler, but yeah. this guy was a smuggler.
So he went for a vacation in Thailand specifically, I remember, and he had his father watch his house. Then the guy, like 6 months later, he got back from Thailand and his dad told him, "Hey, I have a really big surprise for you. Come outside and see the tennis court."
So the smuggler returns home to find that his dad built him a surprise tennis court in his backyard. Okay, the problem was, in the middle of the tennis court, now buried underneath tennis court cement, lay the smuggler's treasure trove of cash.
And so they paved paradise.
Yeah, they
and
paved,
put up a parking lot.
They paved over his money. You know, so I don't know whether that guy ever found his money. I never heard the next part of the story.
You don't know if he, like, hammered up his... he must have hammered up the tennis court.
I would have.
I'm sure he did, because it was at least a half a mil. It was a lot of money.
In the 80s, my dad came up with an alternative to savings and loam, a.k.a. burying cash in the yard. Now, my childhood house had two bathrooms, one for the kids, which had a wall-sized vintage map of the world across from the toilet so we could learn geography, and my parents' bathroom, called the Flamingo Bathroom, as my mom decorated it with vintage flamingo kitsch. The Flamingo Bathroom had a copper sink, handcrafted by my uncle, my mom's brother, the same one who left my dad at his sister's house to recover from the Big Sur acid trip we talked about in episode 2. So, when my parents redo the Flamingo Bathroom, they embedded a safe in concrete under the copper sink in the bathroom. I loved the Flamingo Bathroom's vibrant pink Muppety birds, and I would frequently poke around under the sink for Band-Aids, toilet paper, and Neosporin for my many wounds due to innate clumsiness. I had no idea that under the first aid supplies, beneath a false sink floor, lived a safe stuffed with the Himalayas in cash. Well, this also ends up being a terrible idea.
It was poorly thought out.
Well, it was really well thought out, except for one issue. But it was a great stash place until that happened.
So what happens? Basically, they have over half a million in cash hidden in this safe under the sink. But what my parents didn't know was the water district was installing high-pressure lines in our neighborhood so water could flow uphill faster. So all of a sudden, on a beautiful Mill Valley afternoon, my dad hears a big boom coming from the Flamingo bathroom.
Wherever I was, I came into the bathroom, and it's fucking flooding under the sink. And I was rather crazed. I mean, just seeing this thing. This is how you learn how to deal with emergencies. And I was just crazed, wondering what the fuck happened.
My dad doesn't remember the water department's warning that they were installing new high-power pressure lines. So torrents of water are gushing into the bathroom, flowing right under the sink where the safe is buried. My dad can't get the water turned off inside because the water valves in the bathroom have exploded off their hinges.
So the next place to go was outside where my water turnoff was, and I got to that, but not before. I mean, a pile of water, and it was like a swimming pool, the safe, right? So the whole thing, which was full of cash,
because that's how the universe works,
of course. While I was uptight, it was just absurd. You could not fucking write this, create this, you really couldn't imagine this happening. So I got the water shut off. That's the first thing. Then I opened the safe and I took out all these bills, I mean, that were swimming.
And they're thick brick nib. They're like
well,
bricks.
They're in packets of 50 or 100 bills of whatever the bills were.
They're just soggy.
Well, they're more than soggy. I mean, they're waterlogged completely, and it's like, oh, fuck, what do I do now? I mean, what do you do now? How do you dry out? You know, if you're going to dry out $1,000 in 20s or whatever, you got 50 bills. But if you're going to dry out a lot of money,
oh my God.
You know, and so It required, obviously, great creativity. It required a fucking solution is what it required.
The solution? Ah, well, my childhood bedroom with its bestickered door was right next to the laundry room, which was always humming with loads of clothing. On cold days, I loved immersing myself as fully as possible into a dryer load of hot fabric. I think I even tried unsuccessfully to squeeze myself into the dryer once, for fun. So how is my dad going to dry all this money? He could blow dry it with a hairdryer, but he decides to throw the cash in the clothes dryer and literally launder the money.
How do we get it in the dryer? I can't just dump it in the dryer. Because you couldn't just dump all these soaking bills, you needed to have them in clothes. So I put them in socks. I undid all of these pants and so that they would be loose in the sock. And you couldn't fill a sock too full because there wouldn't be air between the bills and stuff. And I just started filling socks and putting them in the dryer.
My mom says they didn't end up ironing the bills, but she did consider it. So living a cash-only life presented ongoing issues for not only my parents, but also most colleagues in their professional circles in Mill Valley and New York. Apparently in New York, people often dealt in fives. Now, fives were a big issue in my dad's line of work.
It's very heavy, lots of fives. So nobody wanted them, so like I always had like pockets of fives. You can imagine how hard fives were to process.
Imagine $20,000 in fives. Awesome, because it's $20,000, but weighty and taking up a lot of space. Quite a few smugglers seem to have a hard time keeping track of all their cash. My mom remembers a New York smuggling associate, who once brought her a broom for a housewarming gift, having a major cash issue that any absent-minded and very stoned person can relate to.
This guy we used to call the ferret. The weasel. He was very weaselly, but, you know, he was really trying hard. And he must have gotten too whacked one day because he put his briefcase on top of the car and forgot about it.
Oh, that weasel.
Yeah, the weasel. Yeah.
So what was in the briefcase and did he drive away and what was lost?
Oh, what was in the briefcase with cash, $50,000. And by the time he realized he didn't have his briefcase, he turned around and went and got it, but it wasn't there. New York City, you know, it was like, oh. Then he told everybody, and we thought it was...
kind of schmuck he was.
You know?
Ah, yes. Yet another reason to stay sober while working in the cash-only smuggling world. So losing money was a part of a cash-only life. One of the Mary Jane mamas, Candy Can from the last episode, told me that in the life of a smuggler, you lose money as fast as you make it. She told me a ridiculous tale of losing a lot of cash after a spring cleaning gone awry at a stash house.
I'm in the stash house. I bring in a garbage bag with 80,000 cash in it. And I had given the boys a huge lecture on cleaning the house and on cleaning the house. But I left this garbage bag in the kitchen the night before so we could clean it up in the morning and count it. And I didn't want to, you know, take it anywhere else. So I left it there like a cat would leave a mouse. So the partner gets up early and decides to surprise and takes the garbage bag out to the trash. Well, I wake up after, you know, up all night and I go, where's the garbage bag? Well, I took the garbage out. You should be so happy. And I said that was $80,000, and we proceeded to get in a physical fight with hands around people's necks. And the only reason that I wasn't choked was because my arms were longer and I was able to keep them at bay.
So in the early 70s, $80,000 was worth about $500,000 in today's money.
What happened with the $80,000 in the garbage bag?
We scoured the dumps. We went to, it was gone.
Okay, so the guy who threw out Candy Can's garbage bag of $80,000 and then tried to strangle her? Turns out he's the dad of my third grade best friend who I used to play strawberry shortcake with. The pot smuggling world just keeps getting smaller. So an all-cash life was more common back in the olden days, but it could still be suspicious. Like, my dad was paying big sums of money, all in cash.
How did you do things like pay for my private school?
Well, you know, paying for your private school in the early days was not that big a deal. I would either get cashier's checks. I opened bank accounts. I had bank accounts. I ran just enough money through, you know, and I think, I mean, in the 70s and 80s, things were fairly easygoing. The 70s, they were really easygoing. And we were always very cautious compared to lots of other nutcases who just didn't give a shit. But we always drove BMWs.
Yeah, did you pay cash for them?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they didn't give a shit. I mean, the first BMW I bought in 1972, I bought a new 2002 because that was the car of the world. And I just walked into the BMW dealer in San Rafael. I said, I want that. And I gave him $4,000 in cash.
My dad makes a point that in Marin County, buying a BMW with cash wasn't atypical. Because as we're doing this podcast, we're discovering that tons of people in Marin were doing the same thing as my dad. Now, Northern Marin is more conservative, populated by people living traditional lives with conventional jobs. But West and Southern Marin is where all the psychedelic pioneers of the 60s moved to raise kids in the 70s and 80s. So it was chock full of rock stars, artists, and drug smugglers. And Mill Valley, specifically, with its close proximity to many secluded beaches and the seaside tourist town of Sausalito, prime locations for drug loads to boat into, is thought by old-school Mill Valley peeps to have had a population of 50% smugglers and drug dealers. That's half. Half the population. My dad didn't realize this at the time because no one openly talked about the drug smuggling industry. But eventually, it became clear that everyone was in the industry. It was the culture of Marin County, and it still is the culture of much of Northern California.
I guess everybody else in Marin County was doing the same thing.
But just because a lot of people in Mill Valley were doing the same thing, that doesn't mean my dad wasn't totally stressed. We've heard of several smugglers who ended up in prison because they got busted, but not during a trip. After, when the IRS asked where they got their money from. Now, you could put some money in the bank for cashier's check or buy a BMW, but how do you hide hundreds of thousands of funny money from the government? For my dad, the answer to that was also found in wine country. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime. We'll be right back. Ah, Northern California, known for its pot, the scenery, and its wine. The only alcohol I grew up around was fine wines. Drinking wasn't part of the culture I grew up in, except for very expensive wine, champagne, and occasionally imported beer. When I went back east for college, I was amazed at the prominence alcohol played in the lives of my college friends, and surprised that pot was taboo in their homes. They had all spent their high school years raiding their parents' home bar. I didn't know anyone with a home bar in their house until I went back east, where boxed wine and well-stocked home bars were the norm. I didn't know I was bougie until then, because I didn't know there was such a thing as cheap alcohol whose sole purpose is escapism rather than flavor and experience. So my dad became a wine enthusiast through his close friend, Neil. Neil was another nice Brooklyn Jewish kid who loved music and getting high. Neil was also a smuggler, based in New York, and supplied drugs to big bands like The Grateful Dead and Blondie. Neil was one of the people my dad worked with in New York when he would deliver cross-country from Mill Valley. He later became my little brother's godfather. Neil was wonderful, and he enlightened my dad on the finer things in life, like wine. Because Neil pointed out that fine wine collecting and reselling was the perfect place to clean your money.
Okay, so I'd make a hunk of $25,000, okay, on a trip. And I always wanted to, at the same time, I was always thinking about how to clean it. And so I started buying more wine at a time. as these hunts would come in, I would start buying 5 or 10 cases of something.
My dad was always under pressure to make his money appear earned from an honest living. In other words, how to launder his money. Not literally like the money that got soaked under the bathroom sink, but money laundering. The illegal process of concealing the origins of money obtained illegally by passing it through a complex sequence of banking transfers or commercial transactions. Of course, the overall goal returns the money to the launderer in an obscure and indirect way. So under the Bank Secrecy Act, banks and other financial institutions must report to the government cash deposits greater than $10,000. Plus, banks are also supposed to report any suspicious transactions, like unusual deposit patterns below $10,000. So my dad could never park his cash at the bank without arousing suspicion. So he could never dive into traditional investments like CDs, stocks, bonds, etc. He had to find another way to make money out of his money. My parents launder their money in a variety of ways. In commercial transactions, buying art, gemstones, antique books and rugs.
Rugs?
Yeah, rugs. These were antique tribal rugs, not Persian rugs. So, yeah, I mean,
we didn't use them on the floor.
You've seen several of the different ones we have hanging. These were all really collectible items.
Then.
And they're still collectible now. What we have is really old carpets.
Now, other ways to launder cash are buying vintage cars, jewelry, storing it offshore in the Cayman Islands or Switzerland. Of course, you have to transport it there, hence smuggling cash in yarn balls on planes. Or a simple cash-only retail business like an ice cream shop, bookstore, or sandwichery. Wine, however, was my dad's primary commercial transaction. He became a bit of a connoisseur with all the collectible vintages, buying in bulk for future resale when the wine had aged, becoming more valuable.
Did you have an inkling where my dad got his cash from? Did it matter? Did it care? Did you ever think about it?
I didn't think about it until I was involved in it.
This is Sunset, a wine gourmand who sold my dad wine throughout the 80s and became a close family friend. And to be clear, he had no idea that my dad's initial interest in wine was fueled by money laundering.
Always told me that his primary source of income was introducing entrepreneurs to people who supplied money, and that he got a commission for doing so. That was, but you know, he would often introduce me to people and say, "We've got a deal in the works," and I never felt any reason to discount that.
He does remember that one time my dad showed up to pick up some wine in a long pickup truck with a dome over the back. That's our family yellow truck. It smelled like pot, but he didn't think twice about it because, again, this is Mill Valley. Pot, like wine, was part of the fabric of Marin County.
Well, my first impression of him was he was really enthusiastic about... He had discovered fine wines, and I don't know for how long prior to that. He might have been drinking them with friends for years. But he was really enthusiastic, and he loved to hear about them and talk about them. As you can see, I like to talk about them. And very personable, and thought your mom was a sweetheart. Never felt anything but warmth. Did I ever get the feeling that this was funny money that I was being handed? No. But then I was... very naive on that subject now.
The thing was, it wasn't that unusual for people to come in shelling out hunks of cash to invest in wine. Marin County was, and still is, an absurdly wealthy place, one of the 5 wealthiest counties in the nation. And in the 80s, it was chock full of cash-only shoppers from the sex, drugs, and rock and roll industries. As we mentioned before, at one point, it was estimated that half of Mill Valley was involved in the smuggling business. It wasn't weird for Bay Area big spenders to shell out thousands in cash on a single visit to the wine shop. My dad was definitely not the only one spending briefcases of cash on wine. But suspicions aside, wine and food became the focus of the relationship between my dad and Sunset. Dad says the first time he visited Sunset's wine shop was with Neil. Sunset swore they would see God after taking one sip of a fancy French wine.
And it was really incredibly rich, and not like you think of sparkling of champagne as this very light, but it was very thick and unbelievably flavorful.
Did you see God?
Taffy?
No.
Did you not see God, or did you?
I didn't.
Oh. What did you think, Mom, of Dad buying, putting his money in wine?
I thought it was stupid. I just thought it was, like, a waste, you know? I thought we should buy old cars.
Now, according to Wine Spectator magazine, only a small percentage of wines have the potential to improve with age. And within this group, only a small percentage have the ability to appreciate in value. These elite wines are considered, quote, worthy of collecting from an investment point of view. Sunset would help my dad decide which wines to invest in hopes that their value would increase exponentially over time.
Sunset was constantly getting various new wines and the latest vintages of blah, blah, and reading about it because it was his biz. So he was really knowledgeable. And at one point, he's reading about the fact that he says, listen, Walter, the 82 vintage of French wines is said to be the greatest vintage of the 20th century. And we can get futures of buying bottles of Lafite and Mouton 82 and Petrus and Léoville, Les Cas, and we can get the most expensive in futures. We can buy them now. They'll deliver it in 3 years when they're ready to be delivered. And I could get the futures at $50 a bottle for the Lafite and Mouton, which ultimately ends up selling. If you look at 82 Mouton right now, it's probably somewhere between $3,500 and $5,000 a bottle.
To give you an idea of how much wine my dad bought, he had to rent a storage unit for the enormous collection. Let's just be clear, we had a wine storage unit and a pot storage unit. There were always 10 to 20 bottles at home, but the thousands of other bottles and cases lived in a special climate-controlled locker specifically for wine, which I never visited. Probably a good thing since I'm super clumsy. My dad had thousands of bottles of wine, and he became a bit addicted to collecting it.
That started to get me more and more addicted. I mean, I liked drinking wine, and it was really nice, but I just realized, one, I'm not a big drinker, and never have been anyway, but we would drink, you know, we'd have our caviar. So we'd go have parties with not a lot of people, just a few people, because we were drinking really expensive champagne and triple O Beluga, which Mom really did love. I'd never got a taste for the Beluga either.
Yeah, champagne and caviar, yeah.
Great, super
yeah,
great
it's
champagne.
It's not overrated.
Now, wine was an awesome investment, but both my parents regret not buying more California land and real estate with their cash. My dad did buy our family a wonderful vacation home in Lake Tahoe, where I'd bring all my friends for weeks-long slumber parties. Me and Petunia from episode one built a mini golf course over several summers at our Tahoe house.
No, here, there, there. I think we should have bought land for cash. Is what I think now, looking back on it, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Hindsight tells us that I was not clear back then that, oh, much property actually can be bought directly for cash. Because lots of people own stuff.
Rural properties.
Right, you know. Rural properties or whatever. And
so that's okay. It's, yeah.
We still made a ton of money on the
wine.
Yeah,
we had a good time.
Yeah.
But I always thought it was pretty decadent to drink champagne.
And eat triple O Beluga?
Yeah. I mean, you know, pretty much.
Didn't prevent her from doing it.
No.
But we didn't do it that often. We were not that, you know, every once in a while we'd do some. And we were never quite, you know, and for me it was strictly an investment.
My parents don't think there's any sense to regret what they didn't invest in or regret the ways they cleaned their cash, or dried it, as the case may be. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime. And we'll be right back. We're headed towards the end of this episode, but before we get there, I want to talk about the tiniest currency that was the most important to my parents, and it turned out, to me. So a visceral kid memory this podcast has jostled is one of tons of quarters around our house all the time. They were in drawers, on countertops, and in like every nook and cranny of all our cars.
And they were not only in the car, but they were in all the vehicles.
Yeah, there were a lot of quarters around.
We had two Chevys, right? Chevy Impalas, and we had the big yellow truck. And so they were always in those because those were the working vehicles.
One summer, we rented a house in Stinson Beach, and my parents hired a neighbor girl to be my babysitter. I was probably 8. The beach house was down the street from a snack shack that sold forbidden junk food. So sensing light at the end of my junk food deprivation tunnel, I showed the babysitter the rolls of quarters located in my dad's car door side pockets, and we took a roll to buy frozen Snickers. A few weeks later, after the beach vacation, the neighbor babysitter was caught sneaking up our long, hilly dirt driveway and stealing rolls of quarters from my dad's car. I was so embarrassed that I had shown her where my dad's money was, and I was surprised she had stolen from our family. Later, as in, like, now, while producing this podcast, all these quarters in my life fall into place by learning the rolls of quarters were an important tool of the trade for my dad's business, because he made most of his important smuggling deals on payphones.
Before pagers, they'd call you at home and say, hey, man, why don't you, you know, let's go to the office, meet you at the office and we'll talk.
Oh, you called the payphones offices.
Yeah, I mean, it was an office,
right? It was an office.
So, you know, meet you at the Western office, I'll meet you, whatever thing.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
Now, as a kid, I was deeply absorbed in my fantasy world and considered grown-up errands profoundly boring and barely tolerable. I was a drama queen child, and I couldn't fathom why my parents didn't have errand-running British servants like Mary Poppins, Jeeves, or Mr. Belvedere. Of course, the 70s and 80s were before the internet, so all errands had to be run in person, with the kids in tow. I have vivid memories of frequent trips to the bank, waiting in line, and chewing on the foamy vinyl ropes dividing the banking queues. I loved the spongy texture of the chunky bank cords, the only saving grace of what I considered the most boring errand on earth.
You always made your boredness known, one way or another.
I recall swinging on the cushiony ropes and remember my mom's mortification at my public animal behavior. Well, now I realize my parents needed to go to the bank a lot to get rolls of quarters for my dad's many payphone calls.
Getting quarters was a trip in a bank.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I'm trying to think about it, because when you think about it, what do you need a million quarters for? You know, and you'd go in and buy $100 worth of, because each roll was $20 worth of quarters. So you'd buy 5 rolls, $100, you know.
Did you have different banks? So they wouldn't suspect that you were, why was this person getting so many rolls of quarters all the time?
Well, when I would get quarters, I'd just go into a bank that didn't know me, that was somewhere else. I didn't walk into my Mill Valley Bank or my local. Yeah, you know, and there were enough banks in the county to just pop in now and again.
Another common errand I loathed was my dad stopping for phone calls. We lived in a semi-rural area and drove a lot, as school and my many after-school activities were 15 to 50 minutes away from home. My chauffeur dad always had to stop for a call after gymnastics, tap dance, or play practice when I was tired and cranky and totally had to pee. Disgruntled, but surrounded by rolls of car quarters poised for the spotlight, I'd wait in the car and play pretend, turning the coins into anthropomorphic characters in my elaborate melodramas. Once, while waiting for my dad to make a call, I broke the car windshield by mistake.
Do you remember that time I mistakenly broke the windshield of the car?
With your feet up.
Yeah.
You just put your feet up and went blip.
Yeah. It cracked the whole front window.
Yeah, I do remember that.
So basically, while I sat waiting in the car near my beloved McDonald's, I was in the front seat of our Jeep Cherokee, and I put my bare feet on the inner windshield, leaned back, and pressed slash stretched out. Well, I stretched my legs a bit too firmly, and horrified, watched the entire windshield crack. It was a long 10 minutes waiting for my dad to return from the payphone to the windshield I'd just destroyed. Also, it probably wasn't the best thing to do, bringing attention to my dad as he was making deals at the payphone. Now, my dad went to plenty of different offices, payphones, and his favorite was in Tam Junction near my childhood home. Tam Valley, adjacent to Mill Valley, is where I learned to ride a bike, drive a car, and its crossroads, Tam Junction, is the gateway to the windy road over Mount Tamalpais to Muir Woods, the famed national monument. Tam Valley used to be considered kind of like the slums of Mill Valley, with its hub, the scrudgy Shoreline Shopping Plaza, and the gaudy rug store flaunting a giant curved aqua tile storefront that resembled a vertical swimming pool. So the Shoreline Shopping Center, where my dad's favorite payphone was located, consisted of the Callum Market, where we picked up last-minute groceries, the Shoreline Coffee Shop, and the Video Droid, my little brother's favorite place.
I just had a visceral memory of being left at the Video Droid a lot. Wow. You were probably on the phone, and we'd be at the Video Droid.
Because right around the Tam Junction there were several.
Like you'd leave us a Video Droid so we could look at videos, and you'd go make a phone call.
Yeah,
that happened all the time.
Now, other smuggling errands, which I enjoyed more because they involved snacks, included shopping at the cheese store, Jerry's Meat Market, Mill Valley Market, and the hippie health food store, Living Foods, where we'd get treats like frozen yogurt or tiger milk bars. You know, smugglers gotta eat, and my parents are gourmet cooks. So I thought I remembered plastic-wrapped chunks of hash in the freezer alongside the frozen bagels, but my parents are adamant they wouldn't have left drugs in the freezer for me to eat by mistake.
Did you just have hash wrapped in plastic in the freezer? Like, all the time, right?
Hash wrapped in plastic in the freezer?
Yeah. No, there were always weird things in the freezer that were like little bricks of, like, brown things.
Might have been money.
Money?
Yeah, in bags.
In the freezer?
I mean, we didn't put stuff, we didn't keep drugs in the freezer.
Well, that is ridiculous. I have seen drugs in your freezer.
Really?
Yeah, but not, I mean, recently, you know, pot brownies and stuff.
I wouldn't leave those around. You would have eaten them all.
Yeah.
I don't know what I saw, but my parents always have kind of weird things in the freezer. Like maybe old psychedelic mushrooms or an old withered pot brownie some old hippie left. You got to be careful what you eat in my parents' freezer. Smuggling as a word sounds so intriguing and mysterious. And it's hilarious to realize that, in fact, the most boring activity of my childhood, running errands with my parents, with plenty of quarters in tow, was actually part of a cinematically spine-tingling act. Smuggling. My parents should have been like, come on, let's go smuggling, rather than, let's go run errands, we gotta run errands, like, we gotta do smuggling. I probably would have been much more excited. A question we've gotten from some listeners is that if my dad was pulling in so much money doing these pot deals, why did he keep smuggling? Well, my dad was a freelancer, meaning he would win big, but then there would be months without work or income coming in. And life with three kids is expensive. I've paid my rent being a lifelong freelancer thanks to principles my freelancer dad drilled into me. And number one is, failure is, unfortunately, a frequent visitor. But on the bright side, you've got to know failure to know success. In the smuggling business, you need to spend money to make money. So cash was used to invest in another trip, to bring in more money, and so on and so forth. My dad's colleague, the driver, Sandwich, calls it chasing the rainbow. He told me the smuggling business was difficult to get out of because smugglers were continuously chasing the rainbow, with each new trip promising to bring in more money than ever before.
But also very much, I have boundaries about what I will or won't do in my life, even in making money, which is the most delicious ice cream I know. money makes our world be free.
Making money drove my dad. Plus, I believe my parents are adrenaline junkies. They love river rafting, scuba diving, dancing, the rush from the extreme high of making $250,000 in a month. That's some adrenaline. But the money went fast to support a family of five plus pets. My parents were set on sending us all to private schools and providing us with bounteous opportunities like sailing, skiing, singing lessons. Plus, my dad supported his family of origin on the East Coast. And my parents always needed enough money for smuggler's insurance, a retaining fee for the best criminal attorney on the West Coast.
I mean, I gave Bernie Siegel a $5,000 retainer and said, if I call, help.
Except for I remember that I was sitting on some money and it was $50,000.
You were sitting on 50 grand?
Well, yeah, I was, yeah.
Of whose? What are you talking?
No, of our money, yeah.
Where was it?
It was in a piece of furniture that was had a secret entrance.
What?
The safe.
What? Yeah, you no.
Which?
The bed. Remember the bed we built?
No. Well, I remember the bed we built, but yeah. I don't remember.
It had hinges, and you could open it. And
yeah, but you know, everybody knew that. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah, anyway, I remember that.
Money also disappeared because my dad was a tidbit overly generous. He's a staunch supporter of the arts, and often gave away product and money to fellow artists. I mean, he was rolling in it.
I gave away lots of the product to our artist friends. I mean, how I viewed a whole bunch of that was the importance of the patronage for the artists and even and musicians, you know, for me.
In my dad's business, money, pot, and trust were commodities. There were handshake deals, friendship, and an assurance that cash would flow when it needed to flow. Until it didn't. So the 80s roll around, and the Reagan administration starts changing the pot laws. Stakes are getting higher, but my parents continue business as usual, regardless of the danger, because money is freedom. However, money can also bring out the very worst in people. On the next episode of Disorganized Crime, my dad conducts his biggest trip yet, takes us on a triumphant vacation, and then puts his trust in the wrong hands, leading to disastrous consequences. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime. Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter, is written and recorded by me, Rainbow Valentine. Our producers are Gabby Watts and Taylor Church. Executive producers are Brandon Barr, Brian Lavin, Elsie Crowley, and me at School of Humans, and Connell Byrne and Charles Bryant at iHeartRadio. Our music is by Gabby Lala and Claire Campbell, with original theme by Mark Caron and me. You can follow us online at disorganizedcrimepodcast.com.
Writing our own story, do it as we please. Tamil pies, sleeping princess of the redwood trees. She helps us keep it real. A handshake seals the deal. Grab the stash, seal a meal, and load up these old wheels. Rolling a doobie, young, rich, and groovy. Making it up as we roll along.